Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. We are still back here at NYU, New York City. We had already spoken with Martha Diaz and Marcella Runel Hall. We had talked to them about the Year of Women in Hip Hop, which is dedicated to 2008. But I also came here at NYU because they've been doing some other things that are very groundbreaking. And in particular, I wanted to talk to them about their new book that's out called The Hip Hop Educational Guidebook, Volume 1, and also talk about the organization that you have. You know, we know you for, you're talking to Martha right now, we know you for the work that you've done with the film festival. We know you from, you know, the books and things that you're working on. But this educational piece goes just as deep. And we wanted to find out what's going on, especially since hip-hop and academia are big buzzwords nowadays. So let's introduce people to some of these efforts.
Well, when the organization was started in 2002, it was...
Which organization?
The hip-hop... Well, the Hip-Hop Association didn't really... Let me begin. When I started in 2002, I had an idea of creating a platform, a film festival, because I was having a hard time as a filmmaker finding a place where I could show it. And it was considered edutainment, you know, and so it wasn't very sexy. But I knew that if I could have my own platform, I could screen it all I wanted, and I could also put some other people on. And so I just gathered the activists, the filmmakers, to come and be part of this. It was a huge success. And during that time, I was also teaching.
I didn't know you was a teacher.
Yes, I was a teaching fellow, teaching in the Bronx and in Harlem, Spanish Harlem. And I was just bringing hip hop in the classroom. And that very same film that I was trying to put on, I was using to educate. And I was bringing the CDs, like the Talibs and the Mos.
Do you remember the film it was?
My film?
The film that you...
Yeah, did. It was actually called H2O. And that was the baby version, which the RZA was executive producer on. And it was just showing the five elements of hip-hop. You know, talking about how it started, talking about the culture itself and how it has all these elements and how it's impacted the world. That was really the premise of that short film. And so as a teacher, I was bringing hip-hop in the classroom and I was seeing... Again, success, you know, students coming to class, writing, participating. Actually, other students from other classes were coming, and the principal took notice, and I took notice as well. And together with a sister named Trisha Wong, we decided to do a conference, a summit, which ended up being the Hip Hop Education Summit. And what we wanted was to introduce models and best practices versus just talking about, yeah, it could be used in the classroom. There were too many of those panel discussions and conferences that were just talking about it's a good idea. We actually wanted to show how you can do it and what is going on, who's doing it. And what we realized was that there was a whole group of educators from around the country and the world that were already using it way before we were even thinking about it. And so it was very exciting to see these models. And from there, the idea came that we should put all of these best lessons into a guidebook so that we could continue to inform people on, again, how to use it.
So the guidebook is like, you know, taking the best things, you know, on how to, you know, how do you use hip hop to teach math and how you do it to social studies.
Geography.
So, okay.
Yeah, it's, I'll let Marcella talk. So, well, but it's really, yes, you can use hip hop to teach geography, to teach about the muscular system. I mean, everything from your DNA to, you know, art, you can use.
Okay. We'll talk a little bit about this, Marcella, since you're the main engine behind this book here. We're sitting in her office, her professor office here at NYU.
Well,
cool view of downtown Manhattan. Look at that. Get the window view, so this ain't no small potatoes.
Well, ironically, like Martha said, you know, there was all these people kind of like paralleling, you know, their work and interests. And when I came to NYU in 1997, I was blessed that Nelson George and Trisha Rose and Robin Kelly and all these really influential kind of hip-hop scholars were here. And so I thought this idea of hip-hop in the academy was kind of just where we were going and moving. And then I left in 2002, right when Martha was starting the organization, I went to UMass Amherst. And so we missed each other when she was doing the first summit. I got up there to get my doctorate in the social justice education program. And I began asking questions about why hip hop as pedagogy wasn't included in the curriculum.
Pedagogy, what's that word mean? That's a big word.
It's the fancy word for how you teach, right? It basically means how you teach, right? So there wasn't anything in our curriculum about using hip-hop. And in fact, when I asked the faculty, they said things like, hip-hop, like, how can you call yourself a social justice educator and be hip-hop? How can you, you know, research hip-hop? There probably isn't anything written about that. Where would you write about that? How would you cite that? And I thought that might have been an appropriate conversation in 1982 or maybe even 1992. But in 2002, I was kind of stumped that the only social justice ed doctoral program in the whole country was resisting having hip-hop as part of the conversation.
So what was the reason for resisting it?
I think lack of information, different generation, really civil rights generation who were very activist-minded and saw hip-hop as antithetical to what they understood about activism. And so I started going online, and that's when I found Hip Hop Association and was thinking, oh, I can't believe I just left New York. This is the perfect nexus of all these ideas. Meanwhile, a mutual sister friend of both Martha and mine said the two of us had to get together. And so as soon as I moved back to New York, I had been doing all this research in my bubble in Amherst, trying to collect, you know, ideas and projects and information about all the different national kind of mini movements around hip hop and education. Martha and I got together. She told me about her vision for the guidebook. You know, it was almost identical to what I had been hoping we could do, which I kind of saw as like a giant mixtape, you know, like really like an underground kind of version of all these different artists that hadn't been put on yet, you know, that weren't signed. And we were going to put them in this book and give essays and lesson plans to really get people excited.
How has it been received so far? Now that working?
I think that people have given us so much love. I mean, everything from all different kinds of educators who are doing like different groups, working with all different kinds of youth, formal, informal settings, to parents, activists internationally, and even the media has been good to us. And we've gotten some great reviews and in different publications and some good radio stuff. And I mean, you've been very supportive. So I think in general, people have shown it a lot of love. And most people said, I wish I would have done this, or I thought of something like this, or can I be part of the next one? So I mean, it's been good.
That was the voice of Marcella Rennell Hall. You also heard the voice of Martha Diaz, both with the Hip Hop Association. We're talking about their book, The Hip Hop Education Guidebook, Volume 1. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Davey D, back with you. We are still here in New York City, NYU University, talking with Martha Diaz, talking with Marcella Rennell Hall, and we're talking about hip hop in education, hip hop in the academy. There's a difference between hip-hop education and hip-hop in the academy. At least it seems like it is to me. And I'll start off with you. How do you see the difference in you know, so we get on the same page?
Well, I think for what I've seen kind of chronicling, you know, the history and what's been written and what's been spoken about in the last 30 years is that there's kind of three main ways that the conversation around hip-hop and education shows up. There's either courses about hip-hop, specific courses about hip-hop, about the elements or about the socio-political aspects of hip-hop or the history. Those are mainly in colleges, and I think that's where the hip-hop in academia is, when we're studying hip-hop as its own subject area. Then in high schools and middle schools, I see hip-hop being used to teach other subjects. So while students might learn about hip-hop and learn about the elements in the history, it's really being used in the context for social studies, literature, math, arts, sciences.
Give me an example. I'm in a class. I'm in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. You're the teacher. How are you using that?
I think that I probably would try to make some kind of bridge if I wanted to explore a social issue. So if I wanted to explore something around, you know, kind of underground economies and what, you know, kind of impact drugs have had on society and culture, I might pull a new song and then I might pull something old or have students bring in their own, but maybe I would use KRS-One. So maybe I would use Love Is Gonna Get You. Maybe it's a Boogie Down Production song that those seventh graders never heard because they weren't even born yet, but they could appreciate the content of what that narrative is about being, you know, a young person in your neighborhood and kind of going through life and what you're learning about materialism and underground economies, for example.
That's a good example. You know what? Let's take a break and play that song. I haven't heard that in a long time. And we'll be right back. So there you go. Classic from KRS-One, Love's Gonna Get You, BDP. And we've been talking with Martha Diaz and Marcella Rennell Hall. So you would be able to play a record like this in a classroom and teach people what out of it? I mean, there seems to be so many lessons, but specifically from a teacher, and what would be allowed?
Well, I think that that's where, you know, you get creative. So, I mean, we made a mixtape to go along with the guidebook. We made a clean version that was, you know, a radio-friendly version, and a more explicit version that, you know, had the regular cuts of the songs. So I think in a seventh grade classroom, you would use radio version, and that would be okay. I think that you have to get creative. Maybe you play a clip of a song. Maybe you don't play the entire thing, or maybe you bring in the lyrics and, you know, you make certain concessions if there's words that, you know, wouldn't be permissible. I think that there's all kinds of strong language in Shakespeare and Chaucer and in other places. It's just some of that strong language in hip-hop is what we consider vulgar now, but that's all culturally relevant.
Yeah, well, definitely Shakespeare was all vulgar. Taming of the Shrew, can we say that? But okay, maybe it's just me. What was Bull Tizzles and all that other stuff? But it's just me. I'm the only one that, you know, that noticed they were talking about bull gonads. But that's a classic. Okay, that's just me.
So apropos, yeah.
Let me ask you, Martha. You know, you started off teaching. You know. First of all, give me an example of some of the best practices that you might have included or might have included in this book that people go, oh, I didn't think to flip a lesson that way.
Well, one of my favorite lessons that I created in the classroom was how is one of the okay. One of my favorite lessons that I created was using the elements of hip-hop and connecting it to the motherland and just showing how, you know, these were elements that were just evolving from, you know, from our past and really just globalizing hip-hop in a different way. I also used it in media literacy. Like I would, you know, show different magazines, hip-hop magazines, and ask the students, you know, what are they seeing, and we would like dissect the message behind the ads. The same thing with film. I would bring in Tupac's book, poetry, and we would write poetry, we would recite poetry. We would also bring in Talib and hear his poetry, and just, it was really, I connected everything basically to hip-hop.
So everything's like a teachable moment, I guess.
Yes, because, you know, I was trying to meet the students where they were, and hip-hop was so, it was incorporated in their daily lives that they could quickly get it if I connected it to hip-hop.
Now, what do you say about two things? One, there was often a criticism, well, look, when I came up, we all like to do blues and rock and roll. They didn't teach that in the classroom, you know. We all played baseball. We didn't teach that in the classroom. We need to just have students learn to read, write, and do arithmetic, the three R's. Give them the basics, you know, see spot run, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, and just move on and stop trying to legitimize, you know, the vulgarity that is often associated. We don't need to have Biggie in the classroom. Why is 50 being taught? You know, why can't these kids just be given a book like all the people in past generations, learn to read, do it right, because that is all that it matters, and move on?
I mean, that's not realistic. I mean, right now we're just living in a cool society that we don't need to teach in that way. We have to connect it to popular culture. And hip-hop, I also use it to connect to other genres of music. Like, there were kids, punk rock kids, who were not trying to listen to hip-hop, but I would say, you know, wait, there's a connection. And Latino kids, no, you know, I don't even understand it. But once I connected it to their culture or their genre of music that they liked, they understood that hip-hop is just an evolution of everything. And so we have to include it as a tool, a popular culture tool, that connects the students to what they know and what you want to teach them.
It seems like, you know, tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, I came up at the era when Schoolhouse Rock was on TV, and that seemed to be, you know, I mean, through rhythm, people were able to learn. I mean, is that something, a teaching method that has been proven from your expertise as educators that, you know, if you repeat in certain rhythms, it's easier to learn? I even think when we was in school, you know, I don't want to go that far back, but I think when we was in school, we did like A, B, C, D, E. Yeah, okay.
So. Well, all of that is actually dates back to really age-old African traditions and age-old Eastern Asian traditions. The idea of using music to teach math and science and all of these different things has always been a part of those cultures. So I think that we're rediscovering it now, of course, and making it, you know, making it our own, putting our own spin on it, I think is appropriate. And to go back to your question before about the criticism of, you know, the kind of standard curriculum and the classics, I always kind of wonder, like, which kind of golden age or, you know, which good old days are people referring to? Because we've had disparities in education in this country since the beginning. And so I always wonder when people talk about that, which test scores are they looking at? Which graduation rates are they looking at in saying that we were doing stuff right before as opposed to now? Because I don't think that that's true. I think we can see gaps around class and race historically, and that this is one place we're seeing some gaps closing. I mean, we're seeing test scores improve. We're seeing attrition rates improve because it's culturally relevant. The themes in Shakespeare, you know, which I like to pick on Shakespeare because it's a classic, right? A so-called classic, right? Those themes are the same that are in Biggie, that are the same that are in Tupac, that are even 50 Cent, you know, for all the criticism that people give him because he's here now. Those themes are similar around jealousy and greed and, you know, trying to understand the human condition. It's just whose narrative is it being told from? Whose perspective is it being told from? And the voice and the story and the person attached to it are what are really under the surface of a lot of the criticism, not the themes and not what you can learn from it.
Has there been a fear from administrators and what have you? Because oftentimes within some of the songs, like you pull up A Public Enemy, which Once Upon a Time was always used, all of a sudden you're talking about the Black Panthers and that ain't in the curriculum book. Mm-hmm. Talking about the Nation of Islam. And you're going well deep into social justice themes that people are going, well, you know, we don't want you talking about it because it questions, you know, America. Mm-hmm. A lot of times. Has that been a challenge? Has that been really where the opposition is coming from?
I think to a certain degree, but I think when you couple a Public Enemy song with Howard Zinn or Ronald Takaki, who are clearly not hip-hop. But
I have Ronald Takaki. What you know about Ronald Takaki?
I'm saying, Howard Zinn.
Iron Cages, baby. I remember that. I read that.
I mean, those are those progressive counter-narratives, and that's the same. Those are the same messages. So, again, I go back to who are you really, you know, what are you really afraid of? Is it that idea of knowledge and power and shifting the status quo? And I think, yes, of course people are afraid of that. I mean, that's something we've seen historically. It means somebody is going to have to give up something, right? And so there's always a fear around that. Knowledge is power. And so if you start empowering students that there's actually, you know, a history and a legacy that says you don't have to deal with status quo, it's scary for some people.
You know, as we're sitting here talking, and that was the voice of Marcella Rennell Hall, Asheru, Washington, D.C., Grammy nominated, Mystic out of the Bay Area. You know, Thine Eye, thinking who else? Jay Live. You know, there's a whole list. You know, I'm just thinking of rap artists, you know, Defari, Los Angeles. There's a whole lot of well known artists who teach and often teach. When rap artists, Boots Riley and others, when they start coming into the classroom, are they following the traditional methods, or, you know, because they are rap artists that are well known and they have a certain sort of celebrity, has it made it easier for them to get people's attention? I don't know how to formulate the question, but I always felt like there was just something there when I look at all these rap artists that are teaching, knowing that many of them thought teaching was the easiest because they got the summer off and they could go tour. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, a lot of them, like Mystic and Defari, were really, really, I mean, well-trained and well-heeled, good teachers. And I'm just wondering, with them being artists, you know, and also teaching, what are they bringing uniquely to this table and how it might even manifest itself in the lesson plans you're suggesting to people?
Well, I think what might be very appealing to students is not only that they're an artist, and I think, yeah, you know, it's exciting to have a celebrity come to the classroom, but these particular teaching artists share life skills. They pass on regular you know, advice that a brother would give to a sister. And I think that's really special, and it just bonds them. And it actually, I've been to some of these classrooms, and the students want them to come immediately again, come back, because they don't get that sense of parenting, for lack of a better word, where, you know, they bond with a teacher.
Right, but now does it create pressure on other teachers? You know, I mean, you're sitting there and you got a DeFari teaching, or, you know, Mark Bamuthi, mm-hmm. you know, who is not only a teacher but a principal at one point. So, you know, you're talking like way up, you know, so you got these type of folks. And I'm asking this, I guess, what I couldn't think of before. Here you are, celebrity culture. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, people, if they see you on TV, hear you on the radio, to a young mind, that takes precedent over everything. And here you are. You know, I never seen you on TV, but this guy has a video on. Does that create a sort of potential to either undermine lessons, to create pressure, you know, for a teacher who is not as well known to have to do something to get a certain type of notoriety? Or is it really important that people be on the same page in terms of lesson plans, so whether you're famous or not, you still are covering certain thresholds?
I mean, I think teaching is an art form, so I think that some people are gifted to do it, and other people might have to work harder to really, you know, make an impact and connect. And so I look at it like we each bring our own unique talents to it, and I think that whole idea of taking a village is so true. We have this very individualistic society that says one teacher should be able to teach all things and all things well, but it's unrealistic. Teachers teach from where they're passionate, just like all of us do, you know, what we're passionate about. So if I love social studies, you can bet my social studies lessons are going to be the tightest lessons probably of anything I do. I might do okay with math, but really that's where I'm going to shine. And I think you bring teaching artists in, they can only complement and supplement the curriculum. And the more students that get access to teaching artists and get role models that look like them or sound like them or that can inspire them, I mean, I think that's a great thing. And I think there doesn't need to be a competition or insecurity.
What happens when those teachers, you know, like DeFari being down with the alcoholics, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, you're teaching in high school, but then I seen you on a video with the alcoholics who are drinking a 40 in a video. I mean, right. Does that become a problem?
I think all of that behavior becomes a problem, right? I mean, I think, but you need to interrogate it and have question, answer, be honest. Does it matter if you're in a different stage in your life? You know, do you get to make different choices? You know, I think that students are not afraid to have those conversations. We're the ones that are afraid. As adults, we start to get programmed that we can't be honest about that. We can't talk about people's mistakes, or we can't talk about shortcomings or contradictions. We live in a society full of contradictions, but we're afraid that if we get too, you know, caught up in talking about it, then somehow, you know, we're gonna lose our power, and that's not real power anyway if it's not built on anything substantial.
That's real talk. We've been talking with Marcella Renewal Hall, also Martha Diaz. We'll take a break and then we'll come back and conclude. Davey D with you. We're still down here in New York City, NYU, talking with Martha Diaz, talking with Marcella Renewal Hall, talking about their book, the Hip Hop Education Guidebook. Let me start off with you, Marcella. You know, go through the book. Give us some key things that people really need to look at. They pick up this book. What are they going to find in it? What is some of the things that they really want them, that you really want to underscore? Say, I want you to go to this chapter. Peep this, because this is what you'll really find incredible.
I think for starters, on page 15, at the beginning of the guidebook, we outlined our assumptions and kind of guiding principles about hip-hop and education, and we were very explicit that what this means to us and what it doesn't mean, and what we're hoping will come out of these conversations about hip-hop and education.
What does it mean?
I mean, for us, we're really looking at this idea that it can interrogate, you know, kind of the conditions that we're living in, that there's a social justice analysis in all of this, that it's not just coming in and rhyming your lesson, you know, or learning whatever, you know, lingo or slang that your students are speaking, but it's a much bigger picture. And if
so
it's not...
We don't want the teacher walking in there talking about fishism, my nizzle, and that's that, no? That ain't happening.
Not unless that's who they already are. No, it doesn't need to happen like that. In fact, I mean, what we do caution is it can make things worse, and then you're alienating your students because you're being disingenuous. So we really try to highlight that in the beginning, that we have a real clear set of expectations, and I think that sets the tone for the whole book. I mean, the essays are from parents, scholars, teachers, you know, students. So I think the essays are all good. And then the lesson plans are just exciting. I mean, to be able to teach science and math, you know, and computer skills, you know, those are things people just don't necessarily equate with hip-hop.
Well, computer skills, how do you equate hip-hop with that?
Ori Burton, who works with Brotherhood Sister Soul, shout out to Ori, he wrote this lesson that's all about research and using the internet for creating research papers. But he did all of it topical, connected back to hip-hop culture. So, I mean, if you're reading it and you're trying to figure out how you're going to use search engines or how you're going to construct a research paper, you can really learn from the way he laid it all out.
Okay. What's your favorite lesson plan in there? You know, I mean, pick one. I mean, okay, just give me a standout. I won't say favorite. So some people be like, I thought I was your favorite.
yeah, because I love all my writers that contributed, and we want them to contribute again. And I do think that's the important thing to say is nobody got paid to do any of this stuff for the guidebook, and all the proceeds have gone back to the Hip Hop Association. So when we talk about be about it now, we're really being about it, not waiting until you make it and then giving back. Like, be about it really when it counts. So with that said, thank you, writers. But in terms of a standout lesson, I love Daniel Zarazu's lesson about international geography. I just think it's timeless. He really takes these questions about hip-hop artists and connects them to countries and then has the students find it on a map. And he has the students work in pairs. So, you know, a student who might be really good at geography but doesn't know as much about pop culture or hip-hop culture can find the country on the map, but the other student maybe has that other knowledge, you know, and they can add and answer a question. So just quick.
You're looking at artists, where they come from, and then, because mm-hmm. every artist shouts out where they're from.
Exactly.
No matter what country.
Places yeah. they've been, or like a family member where they had, you know, I mean, it's just, he has this one question about Charlie Baltimore, which is a couple years old, but talking about how she's biracial and one, you know, half of her ancestry is from this particular Eastern European country where there used to be a wall up, you know, around communism. So it's obviously Germany, right? But like, there's all these like kind of intricate facts in there about that. But if you ever saw an interview with Charlie Baltimore, you knew her biracial ancestry, you would know the German part. And then the other student, you know, who's working in the pair can help find Germany on the map. That makes it much more interesting to me. I know, you know, and I'm an adult kind of figuring out, where is Germany? You know, why is that relevant to you? How is it relevant in your life when you're in the sixth grade if somebody doesn't tell you how it's relevant?
Wow. And that's important, especially when most people, you know, when we're such a xenophobic country. Mm-hmm. For such a progressive place, we're very xenophobic. Mm-hmm. Even in hip hop, right. You know, you ask the average head, we're everywhere. Name five groups from Mexico.
Right.
Huh? Huh? Five. Just three. Two.
Right.
One.
Exactly.
Name five from Canada. Can't do it. But we're everywhere. Yeah, that's got to change. That's what you've been trying to do with that association.
Right.
Bring that global perspective, because it seems like everybody else is having a conversation. England knows about South America. Yeah. Kenya knows about Somalia. I mean, everybody has these conversations and they're familiar. And then we show up in the room. We like, well, I know 50 and I know Tony Yayo. And what about your brothers from France? Don't know them. That's not a good look.
That's true. And, you know, what's really great is that I have shown this book all over the world, and immediately you feel the love that they're like, okay, we're going to use it tomorrow, you know, the lessons. And they do know all of our artists, and they do speak different languages, and they do know how to connect it to other countries. And so I can't wait to get some of the results of these lessons plans being used in other countries. We give most of these books away because we want people to use it. We want to tell people, you can do this too. We want people to start evaluating this work, because the next level for this movement is to say, okay, this is how we've helped improve society and the students and the grades and attendance and this and that, and so that we can create a case study so that we can get an earmark from the federal government to go towards these programs in schools.
Right. And for people who are sitting there listening as you were talking, I'm just remembering, you know, the educational system has sanctioned a lot of other quote-unquote art, you know, and pop culture to come into the classroom. For example, there's the TV network. I think it was the TV1 or TV1 mm-hmm. comes into the classroom. Channel 1, right?
Channel 1, yeah.
So, you know, Lisa Ling was the host of it. In fact, that's how she wound up being on The View, right? So there you have that. Then, of course, every major soft drink company has bid to get lucrative contracts where they're in there, and Dan, you know, Dan, they're sponsoring the school. you know. Mm-hmm. So you go to school and you get a Pepsi education or a Coke education. So I guess the point is that corporations, and especially in a world where people are trying to privatize it, seem to have gotten their guises in there, and somehow education becomes product placement. I mean, you tell me. I mean, am I right or wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that runs, there's a danger in this. I mean, the conversations continue back and forth. Should we or shouldn't we be institutionalizing any of this, you know, hip-hop curriculum? I think what Martha and I landed on was that while those conversations are important and there's some, on some level people need to be having them, there's also work that needs to be done. And every year there's students that, you know, aren't coming back to school or are testing, you know, and aren't making it to the next grade. And these could be helping, these lesson plans could be helping them. So I think we landed on, we'll publish it ourselves. Then we don't, you know, we don't owe anybody anything. Nobody can tell us what we can and can't put in there. And there's been some people that haven't, you know, haven't been willing to sell the book because we made choices to leave some of the language the way that it was and to kind of make some artistic choices that we thought kept the integrity of the project. But some of the distributors who might have been able to help push it further said, that's not us. We can't do that. So we reserve the right to make those choices. So I think if people can keep doing it with integrity and not get caught up in the bottom line, we're not trying to get rich off of it. So we don't have any vested interest in the Hip Hop Education Guidebook being in 5 million schools so that we get all that money. We just want people who are interested in learning about it and want to use the lessons to motivate their students to be able to get it.
You know, and school is beyond the classroom. You can use these at home, you know. You know, one of my favorite things is always just looking at lyrics and breaking down.
Yeah.
You know, let's pull out the lyrics. You know, what is Soulja Boy really saying? Right. Let's sit down and let's talk.
And look at metaphors and similes and all of them. You could teach so much to students. And even looking at Soulja Boy from a business perspective, how he was able to use the internet. I mean, it's an amazing entrepreneurial story about how he was able to use technology to get him, you know, his kind of space carved out for him. So, I mean, I think there's something in everything that can be a teachable moment if you're willing to engage.
That's true. I want to get this book. How can I do this?
You can go to thehiphopassociation.org or you can find us in lulu.com.
Amazon.com, barnesandnoble.com. It's really on all major distributors online right now.
If you want to get it for free, if I'm listening to this right now, you know, people in Atlanta and Seattle where, you know, there's a lot of schools. You know, how can I get it, you know, call you up? You got a number? Anything. I mean, you know, seriously, do you got an email? Somebody hit you up on an email they can get that?
Yeah, you can email marcella@hiphopassociation.org or you can hit me up at 212-998-4350. It's my office at NYU.
What's that number again?
212-998-4350.
Okay, you're going to get a lot of calls. Uh-oh. People calling up breathing heavy. I want the hip-hop book. What is the book wearing? What's the book wearing? Okay. All right. Anyway, I want to thank you all. And we are out for now in New York City. Peace.